You're listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh boy.
Large wedge tornado coming up into Tuscaloosa.
A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
We can expect at least another 2 to 4 inches overnight. Then that snow's
coming. The National Weather Service in Huntsville has issued a tornado warning for northwestern Madison.
14 to 22 inches of snow!
Good Thursday evening. Thanks for joining us here on the Weather Junkies. Already June 2nd, so meteorological summer has begun, and it has finally felt like summer here over the last week. Of course, Memorial Day weekend was last weekend, and we had some very hot weather. I'm Tyler Jankowski, joining the show from Connecticut, alongside Dakota Smith, joining us tonight, as always, from Colorado.
Hey, Tyler. Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight. Yeah, I'm out here in Fort Collins, Colorado, as always, and not too much to complain about out here. It's pretty warm, and it looks like it's going to get warmer as the ridge builds into the central part of the country, but really nothing special going on out here. How's the weather up in Connecticut?
We nearly had a heat wave last week. We had 5 days that were almost above 90, and I say almost because day number 3, smack dab in the middle, only hit 89. The other days hit 90 or above. The highest was 93, so it was very warm, crazy warm for that time of year. The record all weekend long was 93, and we tied the record on Saturday, so very hot. The good part of it was that it wasn't with oppressive humidity. It was humid, but it wasn't oppressive, so it could have been worse. And I think a lot of people were very happy to finally have that start to summer, but it was a little too much for some. So I'm kind of, for me especially, I tried to plant a garden, and it was crazy.
I tell you what, you guys need Goldilocks weather to be happy out there.
Oh, come on. Well, this is part me.
Yeah, I know.
Not exactly one for manual labor, so sweating, trying to pretend I'm interested in the garden. I am, but it was hot, and I worked the morning shift, so you got to give me credit. Trying to work in the hot sun after getting up at 2 a.m. is just not a good combination.
Yeah, it's not fun. So I'd probably be expecting some of that weather out here in the next few days. But today we have a very special guest on today. Mark Ellenwood, he graduated from SUNY Albany with a Bachelor's of Science in Atmospheric Science, and he has a minor in Mathematics and Computer Science. He actually won the top forecaster award in the SUNY Albany class of 2009. I thought that was pretty cool, and right now he's a operational meteorologist at Weatherbug and Earth Networks. He started in 2014, and he also co-founded a very, very popular site and Twitter handle, U.S. Tornadoes, with his friend Ian Livingston back in 2012. Mark, thanks so much for coming on with us today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
So how's the weather out there in Maryland?
It's doing pretty good. Typical early June mugginess coming in with the temperatures climbing up to the 80s, much nicer than the damp and cool May we had. Basically, yeah, at least two-thirds of May had measurable rain each day. So,
yeah, that was a crazy stretch of weather down there.
Yeah, never seen anything like it, at least down here for me. But glad that we're back into summer mode.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
So you studied at SUNY Albany in Albany, New York. How did you like the area? What did you think?
Albany was good. It grew up in central New York in the Lake Effect Snow Belt, so I went from 120 inches of snow per year to 65 in Albany, which was nice, but now that I'm in D.C., even nicer. I didn't really appreciate the snow back when I grew up in upstate New York. But
so you're a native New Yorker from central New York, the Syracuse area?
Yep, just grew up a little bit southwest of Syracuse.
Then you studied in the Albany area. So about the little local tornado alley in there?
If you want to call it that.
Well, for someone that doesn't ever really see tornadoes here in Connecticut.
Oh, true, yeah.
It's more active that way. and now you're in Maryland. So we're excited to talk to you about your website tonight. We actually have a Twitter segment, so as we move into that, feel free to comment on the tweets, and then we will get into the main topic.
Sounds good.
Yeah, so let's start first off with a tweet from Eric Berger. He runs the Space City Weather website, and I've heard a lot of good things about it. And I've never really been in the Houston area, but I've checked it out a few times. It's great stuff. Go ahead and give it a look if you have a chance. And his tweet said, "Rain, rain, go away. Hell no, not today." They said they've had a lot of rain on there, and it doesn't seem to be stopping. Because of that rain, they've seen pretty crazy flooding. They had some flooding back in the middle of April, and now they're having kind of another round of flooding, which is not great for property, not great for people trying to move around in that area. Quick plug, I'm actually doing my next Weather Ready or Not podcast on the Houston flooding, so look for that. Tyler, have you been following this flooding at all?
Not in depth. I know it's going on, and I've seen some videos. I saw a video of cattle being washed away in floodwaters today. Do you know how much rain has fallen, an inch amount?
I actually don't. Total cumulative, I have no idea. I know back in April I saw amounts up to 10 inches from one day. But that was back in April.
Because there's been several events this year, but then you look back a year to last May, and then there was another major flooding event in the Houston area. So there's been a lot.
Yeah, they have. So hopefully that doesn't actually look like it's going to get better down there in terms of rain for the next few days, but hopefully they can cope with that and get out of there. The next tweet comes from Matt Mahalik, and he's a friend of ours. He tweeted out, he's a research meteorologist right now. He tweeted out an example of why you can't 100% trust the auto weather products, and he shows a picture of hail that he found that were up to 4 inches, and then the product he's showing shows hail estimated to 2 inches. And to me, this shows how much we still need real ground observations for hail, for even rain amounts from radar.
Is that product that he tweeted an estimation of the size hail that fell?
Yeah, it is. It looks like it's estimating. I'm assuming it's estimating the max size hail. Mark, it sounded like you had something to say there. Chime in.
Yeah, I give people credit to who developed these products, because even though they may not be accurate all the time, it is bounds and leaps forward from what we were even seeing 10 years ago, and to be able to get these estimates, even though they may be off sometimes, it's very valuable to a bunch of different customers who deal with outdoor activities, insurance, and all that. So,
yeah,
as we continue to refine how these are developed, obviously you have limited computing power and limited data, but
yeah, I'm always using those products when the main topic tonight, when I'm chasing, because I'm always trying to see which area I can drive through, which core I can punch, without damaging my car. So yeah, hopefully we'll see some more development and more bettering of those products. Let's move on to our third tweet, and this was kind of a random one, but this is from the National Weather Service in Pueblo, and they responded to me. And they said, "Graphic was compressed in Twitter, much easier to read here. Thanks for the feedback." I kind of gave them some grief about their graphic. I thought it was really complicated, and to me it was kind of, it drew my eye in many, many ways, and I didn't really know what they were trying to convey. And so I gave them a hard time because it's National Weather Service, and that's what I like to do. But I thought it was really cool that they responded, and they took the criticism, and I don't know. I think it's cool when National Weather Service use Twitter to interact with people that follow them.
Yeah, the graphic itself, at first glance, is a bit difficult to read. You kind of have to look at every single little detail to figure out what's going on. And it is a decent graphic. I would think that maybe it would be better suited to be split up into two or maybe three different images, just so it's a lot easier to follow with your eye. But
Well, their tweet is laughable. It's compressed. I can see it fine here on Twitter.
Tyler, you give them a harder time than I do, I think.
A bigger issue than compression. Now, Twitter does compress. I hate how it compresses radar scope images, but I'm trying to figure this out. So are these blue lines rivers, and then the red is a flash flood threat, and the green is snow?
I've opened up a can of worms here.
Terrible.
Yeah, so I wasn't going to go that far, but yeah, I don't know. I think Mark's right. It could have been chopped up into a few graphics. But then I gave credit to National Weather Service in Sterling, Baltimore, D.C. National Weather Service, and they had a picture-perfect graphic, and it was so simple, so easy. I should have shared that one as well. But so I'd like to, I don't know, I like to criticize them, but when I see something awesome, I also like to give them credit because they deserve it.
Well, the other can of worms that you opened is the communication from the National Weather Service. I mean, in the weather enterprise, we have the different sectors, and a lot of people would argue that the National Weather Service is edging too much on the communication and graphics and even in some cases video side of things. I mean, they're trying to do things that they never did 10 years ago. In some ways, it's very positive, but sometimes you have ugly products like you just showed.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot more better good graphics than bad graphics coming out from the Weather Service nowadays, and it's good to see places like you mentioned, Sterling, even adapting. Everybody was a little bit late to the show in the government, and I think Sterling was one of the last three Weather Service forecast offices to join, but they've definitely come a long way in a short amount of time compared to some other things I've seen developing on social media.
Does anyone know if they make these in PowerPoint or something else?
No clue.
Because it's amazing how they all look similar in that there's something quirky about each one, but you know, it gives some flavor to each office. But again, there is that competition aspect. As someone that works in TV, there is a group of people that would argue that they compete. But that's a topic for another day. We're way off topic.
Yeah, good job there, Tyler. Just cutting it off while you could. And finally, this tweet comes from Jay Farlow. You can follow him at Radio W9LW. Seems like he's a weather enthusiast. He has weather as a hobby, and he writes a lot about different weather events and interested in emergency management side of it. And he put up a little article with all of the recent and not so recent weather podcasts that have cropped up. I think it's pretty remarkable how many weather podcasts have cropped up in the past few months. We have WeatherBrains, which has been established for years now. Carolina Weather Group, which has been around for a little while as well. And then us, Tornado Talk is also new. And then there's another one, Weather Hype, really cool podcast. If you get a chance, check them out. It's Weather Hype. And then there's another one, I think Stormfront Freaks or something. So it's, if you're a podcast and weather person, it's a great time to be alive.
We might be the only one that has someone from New England. I want to say based in New England, but you would argue against that.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. That's interesting. If you get a chance, check out that article and see all the cool weather podcasts that have cropped up. But let's move on. We have a lot to talk about tonight. It's a hot button. Well, before we get into that, I just wanted to talk with Mark for a minute here. So you're at WeatherBug right now. What do you do there, and how long have you been doing it?
Well, I've been there closing in on 2 years now. We handle a bunch of private clients that get very tailored deliverables for different threats, and each one's can be very sensitive to the weather or a lot more hands-off, and they just worry about major events like big snowstorms and tropical events. So there's mostly based in the United States. We do some international stuff as well. But yeah, basically right now I'm on the overnight shift, and the overnighters do most of the initial forecasting for the day, getting those deliverables out to our clients so that they're ready in the morning. And throughout the day, we have other meteorologists updating those things as necessary, handling phone calls and all that fun stuff.
So what time do you go to bed and what time do you wake up? What hours do you work?
Let's see. Right now I'm working the 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift. I usually try to sleep throughout the afternoon. I'm pretty good on 5 or 6 hours of sleep a night, though, so It's good for you. More challenging to sleep during the day, but I can usually pull it off.
Yeah, so you also go chasing, and you also started this this website in 2012, U.S. Tornadoes. What was kind of the motivation behind that, and how did that come about?
Well, good friend Ian Livingston, he wanted to get more involved in the world of tornadoes. It's been a very big passion and hobby of his, and he wanted to apply it more, so he made the website U.S. Tornadoes, and he approached me asking if I wanted to be the main forecaster for the site, and I agreed because I love forecasting, and this is a good way to expand my experience and figure out new ways to do things, because right now we've been, for the last 4 years or so, been doing every spring daily tornado threats out to 7 days, which is kind of a scary thing to do because you don't really see severe weather forecasts really going much beyond 3 days, let alone tornado forecasts up to seven. So it's been a fun learning experience figuring out how we want to implement it, how accurate it is, and we've been fine-tuning it over the years and got a pretty good formula going for us now. So
I'm looking at the website now. I don't think I've ever run across the website. Maybe I've clicked on it, but I'm looking at some of your graphics, and for example, the one that says Tornadoes of 2016, is that a map that you guys manually update, or is it automatic, or it looks very nice?
Yeah, that one is manually updated, usually by Ian. He'll go and dig through all the tornado reports that come through. Quincy will help out too. And that's all done in GIS. Ian does most of that. He's self-taught over the years. And we also have Katie Wheatley on the website helping out with the GIS maps every once in a while.
Yeah, I'm looking at the people on the website. There's quite a crew. How did you meet all these people?
All of us actually have met on the American Weather Forums, formerly Eastern U.S. Weather.
Okay.
All of us being generally in the Mid-Atlantic from one time or another, except for Quincy, who grew up in the Northeast. And it's basically just been everybody's passionate about tornadoes, and we want to make content and have it seen, so.
You said that you're good friends with Ian Livingston. We've been meaning to have him on the show. How did you meet him?
Yeah, I met him on the American Weather Forums as well.
Okay. This is the forum crew.
Yeah. When I moved down into the Mid-Atlantic from the Northeast, that's kind of when I saw all these people and got to talking to them on the forum and saw that we had mutual interest in severe weather. And Ann and I have actually been going out to the plains and chasing for the last 5 years, although I took this year off, and he went out with Quincy and had a good time.
So that's a beautiful segue. So you guys go chasing, and it's a hobby. It's something that you like to do. What is chasing to you? Why do you do it? And I guess how do you view it for yourself?
Chasing for me is all about the passion of weather and wanting to see extreme weather phenomena. I go out and chase in the plains, and I try to do backyard chasing on the East Coast every once in a while when the opportunity develops. But I also go hurricane chasing, winter storm chasing. Although those aren't necessarily as fun.
So do you think that your view, how you view chasing, is kind of generally how the chasing community also views it?
For the most part, yeah. It's just a hobby that people enjoy, and we like to take photos and video to, one, catalog what we've seen, two, share it with other people, because it's an amazing thing to watch. And eventually, sometimes you get something good enough to sell, which I've sold things before, not a lot, but it's definitely a good way to help fund your chasing because it's not the cheapest vacation out there, and a lot of people that do chase are out there on a budget, so whenever we can recoup some money from the trip, that's always a nice thing.
Yeah, I echo similar things you just said about chasing. Even though I haven't been chasing for a long time, I just moved out to Colorado, and that's really given me opportunities. And I'm curious. There's kind of, it seems like there's this pushback recently by I don't know, a small group of chasers that like to reason with that they're doing good and it's all, you know, they're doing a service by being out there. It seems like to be a small group, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, for the most part, I don't think chasers really need to defend what they're doing. It's just that the hobby itself is atypical amongst the group of normal people, that they view storm chasing as kind of this strange, extreme thing. They're wondering how people get the thrill of it. And it's like, you just have to have a nice interest in weather and wanting to see weather phenomena to go out there.
So you chase storms. I have not. Dakota kind of dabbles in it from now on. We have a few bullet points here of problems that come up with storm chasing. They are clogging data networks, traffic backups, and chase assistance required. That first point, Dakota, clogging data networks, what did you mean by that?
I had never heard of it, but recently I was scrolling through a bunch of Twitter combos, and I saw that someone making claims that when you get a bunch of chasers streaming tornadoes, that it sometimes I have no idea how it works, but I guess it puts a lot of stress on the data network, and I have no idea how real that is or what implications it has. So that's why I wanted to ask Mark about that, if he ever experienced that.
Yeah. Well, the only time that issue really crops up is if you're in a very rural area that might have one or two cell towers and you have a few hundred chasers trying to get data and trying to stream. And I really never experienced it myself when I was out chasing. The whole data hogging issue is, there's a handful of streamers out there and they try to get the best quality stream they can, but the actual streaming community has maybe leveled off or even shrunk a little bit, and the infrastructure for cell towers is improving as we get on through the years, so that might be why I've never experienced the cell tower issue myself.
So the primary importance of data networks is safety, so that you're able to receive the information and you know what's going on. So that would be your concern if it went out, right?
Yeah, well, you're trying to have all the data coming in for the chasers so that they can see the radar updates, but you also have the locals trying to communicate with each other and trying to contact emergency management. And when there's a tornado going on, you have the cell tower issue that could lead to some missed connections as far as the locals are concerned. But again, that's usually fairly short-lived and in very rare occasion. I haven't really seen on any sort of chaser forums or on Twitter any recent cases, but I know it's been a problem in years past.
Do you know of any old school chasers that still use satellite connections?
Yeah, there's good benefits to having satellite connections. Most people don't use it, number one, because the cell network is usually reliable enough.
And satellites,
and two, they can't. Yeah, satellite data can be somewhat expensive, and it's, number one, the monthly fee. Number two, the software you need to use it. You're usually spending an extra $300 to $500, depending on how long you're out there chasing, every year. And some people can't foot that expense or don't feel the need for it. I've been going out there since 2011, and I've never felt the need to really have the satellite. It's really there for the 5% of the time that you might not have cell data.
So it seems to us that the biggest issue is traffic backups and inexperienced chasers.
Yeah, that's a very sensitive subject for chasers. Because you'll see these long lines of cars on a main road, and usually they're traveling pretty decently, and most of the time, when you have that many chasers all on one road, people are being very courteous and pulling completely off to the side because there's room for it. but you'll also have local people mixed in with that who might not know what's going on, and they're being extra cautious. And also, you have local law enforcement.
Have you ever been in a situation where there's been a backup and it's been a bad thing and it's kind of hindered emergency management?
I've personally never seen emergency management getting hindered by it. There's probably a handful of cases out there where that may have occurred. The worst I've ever seen was there was basically a very small target east of Denver a couple of years ago, and there was one good road where everybody was using it, and there were a few hundred chasers probably on that road at any given time, but I was driving and never had any real issues getting around on that road. You may have had to wait a few minutes to make the left turn to get in with the rest of the traffic, but we were staying far enough ahead of the storm that it really wasn't an issue. So long as you have a way to escape the storm, it's usually fine.
Yeah. Tyler mentioned it, but I put it on, we have a little rundown here, I put it down as chaser assistance, and I haven't really heard of many examples, but just recently there was an example where there were some chasers and they had to get escorted by the police, and if they hadn't, they either would have been injured pretty badly or they could have died because their car was, you know, in shreds after they went and came back and to find it. I don't know what you think about this. Do you think it's inexperienced chasers has become more of a problem, or if it's kind of been always the same same level of an issue?
There's probably more inexperienced chasers getting out there nowadays just because of the fact that with technology developments, it's gotten easier to chase, because you can either just see the radar on your phone or you can see all the storm chaser dots and just go to where all the dots are. But as far as chasers getting into dangerous predicaments, it doesn't really matter how much experience you have. I've seen 20-year veterans getting stuck in the mud near a tornado. I've seen first-year people getting out there live streaming, and all of a sudden there's trees falling right next to their car. So it doesn't really matter how much experience you have, as how much you're willing to risk to get where you want to go.
So what do you think about the too close, too risky thing? Is that, I don't know, I guess if you're a chaser doing it for yourself, it's a risk you're taking. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I think it's all part of human nature wanting to try to protect other people. When people are saying, oh, you're getting too close, it's always up to the person who's chasing to make their own risk assessments as to how close they want to get, how dangerous the storm is. Yes, there are incidents where people are getting injured or very rarely killed in the chasing community, but those are all calculated risks. People made those decisions, and in the grand scheme of things, it's probably not the most dangerous hobby. There's other things like mountain climbing. There's been deaths on Mount Everest this year, and everybody's like, yeah, that's just part of the risk people take when they go climb it. Well, there's similar risks in storm chasing. You can either stay well away from the storm and have no danger, or you can try to get really close and get whatever shot or thrill that you're trying to get from it.
I think it's well established that no matter how much experience you have, you can get killed or you could be put in a dangerous situation. We saw that in the El Reno tornado, and you have firsthand experience. You mentioned the mud, something you'd never think would happen, getting stuck in the mud. I think you're more inclined to think the tornado might approach in a way that you didn't expect, but there are other things that could cause problems. But I think we titled this episode The Ethics of Storm Chasing, and I think my opinion is, it's a free country. There's no rule, there's no law that says you're not allowed to drive into a storm. So I think for anyone that is new and wants to go out, sure, go ahead. I mean, you could do whatever you want. I think the concern is when those people start to add danger to those that have been chasing for many years and that are experienced and that really are meant to be out there. Those are the ones that perhaps are even doing some research. I think that's really the only concern for me. In terms of danger for the everyday person, I could care less. I mean, you could do whatever you want. It's a free country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the main core of the ethics argument that has been getting heated up recently, and just in the storm chasers amongst themselves, not necessarily amongst outsiders, is everybody behaving the way they should be, which is things like pulling your car completely off the side of the road and keeping your tripods off the road, not passing on double yellows, basically just common sense things that you would do during any normal day that you should also be doing while you're chasing.
Well, I mean, if you're passing on a double yellow line, you have other issues with the law.
Yeah, basically, it's one of the things that the storm chaser community is trying to self-police nowadays. But at the same time, I feel like a lot of the people causing these issues aren't getting the message because they couldn't care less about what's going on a storm chaser forum or on Twitter. They just want to go see the storm, so...
It's interesting, yeah, because I'm a self-proclaimed fire truck chaser. I have absolutely chased more fire trucks than I have thunderstorms, and I have my ways of doing things. And generally speaking, I like to disturb the least amount of people possible. So maybe I wouldn't make that bad of a storm chaser.
Hey, maybe in 30 years you'll have firefighter-chaser convergence.
Possibly.
So Tyler kind of gave his hot take, and I want to give my hot take too. It is kind of weird. Tyler and I are kind of outsiders, and that's why we have Mark here to kind of comment on what we're saying. But to me, I always have this kind of sense of guilt when I'm thinking about chasing, because I know I'm not I'm adding to the very small percentage of risk that I don't know if I'm saying it right, but I'm adding a tiny, tiny percent of risk to the people that might be impacted by a storm. You know, it's not probable that I get stuck and I need a cop to help me, and the cop could be doing something else to help the locals, but it could happen. And so that's how I feel when I'm chasing. I still love it, and I can't stop myself from doing it because tornadoes are awesome and supercells are awesome. I don't know, Mark. That's my hot take. I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, it's sometimes when you take a look at the whole picture, it can be difficult to justify storm chasing. But at the same time, it's just, like it was stated earlier, it's a free country. You can go do what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once it's really hard to just point out one or two things and be like, "This is why storm chasers shouldn't be chasing." But there are positives in the overall grand scheme of things. You have reports coming in, sometimes even before the radar picks up the circulation, so you can get faster tornado warnings, more accurate ones. When people are reporting wall clouds, funnel clouds, tornadoes, obviously that's not as important when you have 200-300 people on the storm because there's going to be a lot of people there to cover it. But there are many other instances where there might be only two or three people on one storm, and it's in the far edge of the radar zone, and you're not really sure what's happening on the radar. And to have that kind of ground confirmation is great. Plus, if a lot of chasers will stop in an area that's been impacted and help out if necessary, kind of becoming ad hoc first responders, I know a lot of chasers that do have basic CPR and medical training and do carry a first aid kit and will also obviously help call emergency management if they see something.
Yeah, so that brings up a good point. I made kind of a snarky, sarcastic tweet, and it was subtweeting Dick McGowan, and I felt a little bad about it afterwards because we were direct messaging, and he was telling me how he's donate a lot of his proceeds to the families that have been impacted, and you know, I don't know how much or how little he donated, but he said he did donate some of it and he actually helped out. It was this one video, and it was this, I think it was earlier in May, this May, house was completely leveled, and he has video of it completely leveled, and the title is Violent Tornado Takes Out House, and I just thought the title was kind of insensitive, and I was talking to him after, and he said, yeah, the title is not that great, but I made it that way so that I would get more views and get more money to donate to the families.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, sometimes headlines can be a little misleading or insensitive, but yeah, Dick McGowan's one of the good chasers out there. He actually did an interview on the U.S. Tornadoes that we posted, I want to say, about a month ago. And he's fairly widely known as someone who is a more of an aggressive chaser, and if you rub him the wrong way, he can snap back, as you probably got firsthand.
Yeah, I don't know.
And he's one of the group of chasers who's very defensive about chasing. If you say something ill about chasing, he'll be one of the first people to step in and tell you why you're wrong, usually. But
yeah, he was all over the Eric Holthaus article this week. We had someone chimed in here on Twitter. Ed Oswald, he's been pretty vocal about the recent, chatter on Twitter. And he said, I do think it comes down to folks like Timmer glamorizing getting close, so others are taking unnecessary risk. There's just few reasons to get that close, and a lot of them are profiteers in the industry. We kind of talked about that, how if you want to get that close, you can, and you're putting yourself out there, risking.
I wouldn't say that Reed Timmer necessarily glamorized storm chasing, but he is a very good marketer, and he likes getting close, and he puts his product out there, and people are into it. It's not him trying to hype up the storm so much as people wanting that kind of content, so they go and watch his videos.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I guess kind of turning the subject here, it's actually the reason I messaged you first about coming on. I was commenting on there's a video of one of the Twirl groups who launched a pod right next to I think it was the Big Sulfur wedge that happened earlier this month. And my take on it was they were in that kind of wobble danger territory where something happened that they weren't expecting and, would have been one of probably the worst case scenario. And I felt like it wasn't worth it for the science, and that's their job. And when you're on a job, you don't want anyone to die. You don't want to get injured. And I think I was holding them to a higher standard than a chaser that's just out there for the fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
Curious what you think about that.
The problem with getting on the ground in situ data is, you need to have the tornado pass over your pod or whatever you want to call your research instrument. And to do that, you need to get somewhat close to a tornado. You only have maybe 2 or 3 minutes to deploy it and get out of the area before the tornado hits. That's part of the science, unfortunately. It's very much a calculated risk. Whenever people are going into that situation, they try to use the latest, best data and, of course, their own eyes to the best of their abilities. And occasionally you do get caught off guard. That's the nature of tornadoes. That's why we're putting those pods out there trying to understand them. So it is a calculated risk, and sometimes it comes back to bite you. Hindsight's 20/20. You always wonder, man, we got too close. What happened? How can we prevent this in the future? But, again, you need to get that close in the first place just so you can get the data. So it's kind of hard to judge them. But these people that go out and get the research, they're trying to take as many precautions as possible. But with the nature of tornadoes and storms, there are going to be curveballs thrown over here and there.
Yeah, I guess, my view on it is it's like, I don't know. I wouldn't risk my life like that. I guess it is personal preference. When you sign up for something like that, you know what you're doing, you know what you're getting set up to. I don't think it's worth it. Even though the data is great, and I don't know. I also, another part of it is I really think and wish that we had better technology, that we didn't have to do something that, I don't know, it seems kind of archaic. We have to drop something in front of a tornado, and that's how we get the data. You know, we live in a time where we can, you know, fly stuff and fly drones, and some of that research is cropping up, and so hopefully that, I don't know, starts to take over, so we don't have to get that close. Like, you still have to get close flying a drone, but...
Yeah, well, I think the main reason why people are deploying pods in front is because that's one of the best ways to get data. You have, hopefully, it surviving the entire life cycle of the tornado as it passes over, and you can fit more instrumentation on there. So, and you're getting ground-level stuff. That is the least known, least understood part about tornadoes, what's happening in the lowest 100 feet. And obviously that's what most people are concerned about, because that's the whole part doing all the damage.
Dakota mentioned it briefly. What are your thoughts on drones and how they may impact data gathering in the vicinity of tornadoes?
I personally love drones. I think that having drone footage is exceptionally useful, especially when doing damage surveys. You no longer have to wait a day or two to charter a helicopter and get a full video or survey. And that's something that I think the National Weather Service would have a great benefit of getting these drones and being able to survey, because helicopters aren't cheap. You can get a decent drone for $1,000 to do a quick survey and get the information out there faster, which helps people with insurance claims and recovery. So I'm all for drones, in areas that they're permitted, of course.
Do you think they have any utility during the tornado, or will they get blown down?
If you're far enough outside the winds, I think that would be beneficial for actual ongoing events, because sometimes there's trees and obstacles in the way where you can't see ground circulation, and you have a condensed funnel halfway to the ground, so you're unsure, so it might be more beneficial in confirmation. But I imagine that most people who invest in drones would be a little bit afraid to get too close when you're getting 30-mile-an-hour inflow winds into the storm that could easily take your drone away from you forever.
So tornado tours, there are groups that offer tours to those that want to see tornadoes. Dakota says that he doesn't mind them personally if they're run well and safely, but some people have issues with those tours. What are your thoughts?
It really depends on the tour you're with. There's really good groups out there, and there's really bad groups that are just trying to make a quick buck while they're out there chasing. There's a whole part where it's nice because you're bringing people who don't want to chase on their own, aren't experienced enough, who would be otherwise clogging up the roads. You put them all in a van, you can take them out and show them how to do it properly, which is good benefit for everybody. And there's good chaser tours out there like Tempest Tours, Silver Lining Tours, Cloud9, who do an excellent job every year and are safety. They're safe, they're responsible. So I would highly recommend those, especially to people who haven't gone out before. But yes, there are some tour companies that get a little too close, or they're just trying to get quick money and aren't necessarily good for actually conducting tours.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel. You know, if they're doing it right and doing it safely, then yeah, probably limits traffic, because all those people in that one van would be in a bunch of different cars. There's been so much, I don't know, social media back and forth between chasers and non-chasers and in the weather community. I'm curious, do you have any kind of like overarching thing you would like to say to the chaser community in terms of, I don't know, handling themselves? And I guess that's kind of a weird thing to do, but it seems like it's gotten pretty the peak back and forth and peak nasty.
Yeah, well, it happens every spring. There's a handful of articles out there from people who just don't have the experience in chasing. And the chasers groups themselves are getting more vocal and trying to correct these articles you see out there that are lambasting chasers unjustifiably. And there are issues, yes. Sometimes storm chasers do cause problems either with local law enforcement or emergency management. But I think for the most part, chasers are doing more good than bad. And they're also help. While they do kind of clog up the roads every once in a while, they are doing more to help communities. Like you were mentioning, Dick McGowan donates some of his proceeds to areas that got hit. There are multiple organizations within the chaser community that keep organized donations going every year. I know Skip Talbot runs a small company that does that. Why can't I remember the name of it? But basically what they do is chasers will donate footage and pictures to that group every year and just for free, and it'll get put out by the donation group, and they'll get thousands of dollars from that that all goes towards victims that have been hit by these tornadoes. So, yeah, every once in a while some people will get riled up about people clogging up their road, but think about, they just don't see the big picture of what all the good that comes from the chaser community.
Absolutely. I'm on ustornadoes.com right now, and I have to say it's a great website. You guys lay things out in a way that I would. The tornado shape, sizes, radar signatures. Take 30 or 45 seconds to sell the website to someone who hasn't been on it but is a weather fanatic that may be listening to the show.
All right. Well, first I looked up the name for Skip Talbot's site is Storm Assist. And they're probably one of the biggest contributors for donations.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I've heard about them too, yeah.
Yeah. So US Tornadoes, the website, is a very good compilation of not only forecasts for me, storm chasing summaries from when we go out and when there's big events. We also have a long catalog now of different tornado statistics broken down any which way you can think of. And it's a very good resource for people wanting any kind of tornado information, really. We kind of cover just about everything there is to know about tornadoes, mainly because we're a very niche site. We only focus on tornadoes. We've dedicated ourselves to never branching out to other different weather phenomena. So, yeah, sometimes it gets quiet in the off-season, but we've gotten this very large information database together, mostly for our own interest, but also to share with the community and have as kind of a catch-all resource so people aren't spending hours upon hours digging through different sites trying to scrounge little bits of data here and there.
Fabulous. We have one final question because you know you have to get to work. We know you have to get to work. It's getting late in the evening. We ask this question to everyone that comes on the show. What is your advice to prospective meteorologists, those that may be considering going to school for meteorology, or those that may be struggling through that freshman year calculus class, or just starting out in their career and they're having a difficult time? What is your advice, being that you've been in the industry as a professional for many years now?
Number one, be passionate. I've seen plenty of people come and go through the weather programs where they're interested in weather and they want to learn more about it, but then they see everything that's involved, all the math, all the physics, and they get discouraged. So you really need to be highly passionate to want to get through all that and to continue on as a career, even in this kind of situation where we have a lot more people interested than there are jobs. If you really are interested and that passionate, it's something you really want to do, then you'll make it eventually. And as far as getting through those other classes, everybody struggles with some of those classes. It's a very demanding coursework over the course of your four-year undergrad, plus whatever graduate work you might want to do. And there are going to be a few classes that you struggle in. That's when the passion comes in. You're like, all right, I need to get through these classes. I need to go get extra tutoring. I need to get some more group studies in. And so long as you dedicate yourself and you put the time in, you'll get through it.
Great advice, Mark. Thanks so much for coming on. You know, this was an awesome show, and we really appreciate you taking some time out and your commentary today.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me on.
And you can follow us on the WX Junkies on Twitter. We're also on Facebook. You can listen to this podcast on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, and iTunes. If you're over on iTunes, give us a review or rating. We just want to hear from you. And Tyler, send us away.
Yes, on behalf of Mark, Dakota, and myself, thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us right back here next week.
Cow. I gotta go, Julia. We got cows.